hoping that people don't just come out and then look around and there's nothing for them to grab onto, no campaign, because then it'll just become a thing. It'll become part of culture. It'll become a Che t-shirt, you know.
Boots Riley, director of the new film Sorry to Bother You. Boots Riley is also co-founder of the legendary hip-hop group The Coup. And that does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Nat Needham, and Libby Rainey. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Godarz, and Carl Mixer. And to our camera crew, John Randolph, Kieran Meadows, Anna Osbeck, and Matt Ealing. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KBOO is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KBOO will be hosting Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. This film from 1980 chronicles the life of country singer Loretta Lynn. Sissy Spacek brings sincerity and depth to her portrait of Loretta and does her own singing in the movie, as does Beverly D'Angelo in the role of Patsy Cline. Tommy Lee Jones also delivers one of his best performances. Again, that's Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, I was born to coal miner's daughter.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 13th annual Dancing in the Square American Indian Day Celebration Powwow on Friday, September 7th from noon to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland. American Indian Day is a traditional showcase and celebration of American Indian and Alaskan Native cultures and community, which raises awareness concerning the challenges that Native American people face in this country. This event features vendors, educational booths, food, entertainment, and more. Again, that's Dancing in the Square American Indian Day Celebration Powwow on Friday, September 7th from noon to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square, 700 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:02 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Grendel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. That's 503-595-9550.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on a shortened Labor Day edition of the KBOO Evening News, a Portland police officer is on leave after using a sleeper hold to arrest a civilian.
Several of the teachers' unions on strike in Washington State have reached tentative deals with their districts.
And in international news, the Philippine strongman Rodrigo Duterte met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 3rd, 2018. I'm Mike Fdaklis.
And I'm Ken Jones. There was a shooting at Gateway Shopping Center in Northeast Portland early this Labor Day morning. According to the Oregonian, Portland police responded to reports of gunfire at the shopping center just before 3:25 a.m. A Portland police spokesperson said officers searched for victims and found a man injured at Winco Foods, which is across the street from the shopping center. The man was taken to a nearby hospital. His injuries do not appear to be life-threatening. The spokesperson said police do not have a description of the suspect, but believe the public is in no danger.
As of Monday, some of the teachers who were striking in Washington State have reached tentative deals with their districts. According to a release sent out by the Washington Education Association, teachers in Vancouver, Ridgefield, and Hawkinson have reached tentative contract agreements with their districts. The school districts will vote this week on the contract. Teachers in Seattle, Bethel, Mercer Island, Sumner, Camas, and North Kitsap reached agreements with their districts over the weekend. Evergreen, Battleground, Washougal, Tumwater, and Longview teachers remain on strike. In the Washington school districts of Centralia, Puyallup, Stanwood, Camano, Tukwila, Arlington, Conway, South Whidbey, Monroe, and Wapato, teachers' unions have authorized strikes if agreements aren't reached by the start of this school week. Teachers in Tacoma are due to decide in a general membership meeting tomorrow.
A Portland police officer has been placed on leave after using a controversial neck hold on a civilian. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman has more.
Portland East Precinct Police Officer Larry Wingfield is on paid administrative leave after using a sleeper hold to subdue a man who cops say was armed and resisting arrest. According to a PPB press release, late Friday night, Wingfield and three other cops responded to the 9300 block of Southeast Ramona Street in the Lentz neighborhood on the report of a man with an outstanding Clackamas County warrant for theft. The man, 31-year-old Jonathan Harris, physically resisted arrest, and after the cops noticed that he was armed with a handgun, Officer Wingfield, quote, attempted to apply a carotid neck hold, and the officers were able to place Harris in cuffs. Once Harris was in custody, the cops called emergency medical responders to evaluate him, and they determined that he didn't need any follow-up treatment. Beyond that, information on the event is scarce at this time. Wingfield was involved in two police shootings in 2011 and 2012, one of them fatal. He and the other involved officers were found to have acted within policy for both incidents. However, during the grand jury proceedings for the fatal 2011 shooting of an intoxicated 67-year-old man named Thomas Higginbotham, Wingfield expressed regret that he and his partner had gotten close enough to the man to put themselves in perceived risk. The maneuver Wingfield used on Friday, the so-called carotid neck hold, is more colloquially known as a sleeper hold, or less accurately, a choke hold. Done correctly, it involves holding a person's neck in such a way that the flow of blood to the head is cut off, rendering them unconscious. According to an article from 2014 in Police Magazine, the term choke hold is inaccurate because the maneuver should not place any pressure on the windpipe, but only on the sides of the neck. The article is yet another term for the maneuver, vascular neck restraint, and recommends it for dealing with people who are too intoxicated or delirious to be affected by pain, electric shocks, or verbal commands. The carotid neck hold, or vascular neck restraint, is listed by the PPB as a, quote, use of deadly force, which is why Wingfield has been placed on leave and the district attorney's office is investigating the incident. A sleeper hold was responsible for one of the more infamous deaths caused by Portland police, that of Lloyd Stevenson in 1985. In the aftermath of the incident, police members made T-shirts that read, "Don't choke 'em, smoke 'em." Proponents of the carotid neck hold say that done correctly, it leaves no long-term damage or visible harm. What remains to be seen is how PPB officers are trained to apply the hold, how often, and to what standard. KBOO has reached out to the state's Department of Public Safety Standards and Training about where the hold fits into their basic police field training, and the story will be updated as we hear back from them. For KBOO Evening News in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
Paul Allen, the billionaire owner of the Portland Trailblazers and Seattle Seahawks, donated $100,000 to a political group seeking to keep Republicans in control of the U.S. House of Representatives. The Seattle Times reported that Allen's donation went to Protect the House, a committee headed by House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, a California Republican. Protect the House is a joint fundraising committee, a group that lets wealthy donors make a large contribution, which is then divided among candidates and political action committees. It's the biggest check Allen has ever contributed, according to a review of FEC filings. Allen's June 14th donation came on the same day another NFL team owner, Houston Texans owner Robert McNair, gave $371,500 to the group. Las Vegas casino magnate Sheldon Adelson also gave the same amount, and Tesla CEO Elon Musk has received backlash from some liberal groups for donating $38,900 to the committee in June. Allen and his staff have declined to discuss the reasons for his right-leaning political donations.
Nike, the multinational sportswear corporation headquartered in Beaverton, has chosen Colin Kaepernick as the face of ads commemorating the 30th anniversary of its marketing slogan, Just Do It. Kaepernick was the first NFL player to take a knee during the playing of the national anthem as a protest against racism in America, particularly the indiscriminate killing of black men by police. Kaepernick's protest started during the 2016 season when he was starting quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers. Since then, he's been unable to find a spot on an NFL roster despite his talent and experience. Kaepernick and another former 49ers player, Eric Reed, have filed collusion grievances against NFL owners. Last Thursday, an arbitrator denied the league's request to dismiss the grievances, which means the case will continue and possibly proceed to trial. But back to the new Nike campaign, Kaepernick tweeted today a black and white photo of himself featuring the Swoosh logo and Just Do It slogan, along with this quote, "Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything." According to ESPN, a Nike vice president of brand for North America, Gino Fisanati, said, "We believe Colin is one of the most inspirational athletes of this generation who has leveraged the power of sport to help move the world forward." Today's news of Nike's new ad campaign comes just days before the start of the NFL regular season on Thursday night. In light of continuing protests by players, the NFL recently suspended its rule requiring all players to stand during the national anthem, with the option of staying off the field until the ceremony was over. The league is currently in discussions with the players' union on the policy.
Being a mother is difficult enough on its own. Being a mother while grappling with opioid addiction can be all but impossible. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman has this story from the Oregon News Service about a program in Southern Oregon that is confronting this aspect of the country's opioid epidemic.
While the United States continues to grapple with the opioid crisis, an addiction treatment facility in Southern Oregon is offering hope to mothers. The Addictions Recovery Center, or ARC, in Medford, recently received a $30,000 grant from Jackson Care Connect for its program aiding expectant and new moms with addiction services. The residential program, known as Ready House, will be available to provide up to 14 adults and 4 newborns with beds at a time. Joe Wilson with ARC says treatment for a substance abuse disorder on its own is a difficult process.
With Ready House and with the population there, the new and expectant mothers, there's an additional layer of teaching life skills to also cope with being a parent. But that, in conjunction with everything else they're going through, is just as much of an opportunity as it is a challenge.
Wilson says therapy for substance abuse can involve a lot of components, such as unpacking patients' childhood trauma and dealing with legal issues. August 31st was International Overdose Awareness Day, and drug addiction is a deadly issue nationwide. A record 72,000 people died from drug overdoses in 2017. According to ARC, 6 times more mothers started seeking addiction services after Oregon expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Darren Dale with Jackson Care Connect says the Ready House program will assist an underserved population and offer healthy beginnings to babies, some of whom could be born with drug withdrawal disorders. Dale says women in the program will also get a healthy start to motherhood.
Keeping in mind that a lot of these mothers that are accessing services are 24 years or younger, these are still young women getting started in their life. So by them getting into treatment early, that falls in line with the healthy beginnings piece too.
ARC expects Ready House to open its doors this year. ARC's Joe Wilson says these addiction services will help families and communities as well as the next generation.
Allowing that crucial bonding to occur between the mom and her children allows for the break of that generational cycle of addiction that far too many families experience generation after generation without a chance to break it. So this is an opportunity to get ahead of the substance use disorder before it has a chance to take hold.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman, reading a story written by Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
Thank you.
You're listening to a shortened Labor Day edition of the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:30 for a special presentation of WINGS, the Women's International News Gathering Service, with an episode on women fleeing Guatemala for refuge in the U.S. and the ambivalence of the current U.S. Justice Department towards their plight. At 6, it's Labor Radio, followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather here in Portland and east of the Cascades will be clear with a low of 51 and a 10% chance of precipitation. Today in history, in 1838, Frederick Douglass escaped from slavery by boarding a train in Baltimore for Delaware, where he crossed over into the anti-slavery stronghold of Philadelphia. Also on this day in the year 1260, the Mamluk Sultanate of Egypt defeated a Mongol invasion at the Battle of Ain Jalut, preventing the Mongol conquest of the western Middle East. Today's quote is from American musician, composer, and instrument creator Harry Parch, who died on this day in 1974, and he said, "Life is too short to spend with important people."
And now, a commentary on the meaning of Labor Day from Teresa Mitchell.
Labor Day was established by Grover Cleveland's 1887 suggestion in order to keep the working class from organizing around May 1st. The state of Oregon was the first to adopt it, and it was national policy by 1894. The idea was to distract attention from the much more frightening to the yachting class holiday, May 1st, International Workers' Day, which around the world still celebrates the Haymarket Martyrs. Labor Day today is merely a sop to the working class thrown by the inheritance class. But even so, it is more attenuated than that because it doesn't apply to the entire working class. For example, today I was able to go to a local grocery store, one that used to have some union representation. It was open. I didn't have to plan in advance. I knew that it would be open because the lower working class doesn't get this day off. The banking class gets it off. The attorneys get it off. The CEOs and much of the managerial class takes it off. In fact, for them, it's part of a traditional 2 or 3 weeks of being off work. But middle management and the mere common workers, the worker bees, well, we're all there in the workplace, and Labor Day means absolutely nothing to us and never has. There are many of you listening to me right now who have never had a Labor Day off. The presence of this Labor Day, dispensed to you as if in largesse, is to keep you from thinking of the structure of the society that you are in, specifically that you are bound to a capitalist society and your status is scarcely more than that of serfs. Your contribution in the work world is limited and defined by your employers, and your consideration, understanding, and even knowledge of the direction and management of the firm that you work for are not at all welcome. In fact, they would be considered criminal spying, whereas if you worked in a cooperative, a real worker-owned cooperative, you would need to know at least the basics of everything the firm was doing, and that would be to your advantage because you would be able to vote on the direction, nature, frequency, and even intensity of work, and you would be able to distribute the fruits of your work equitably. Of course, being involved to that degree would also be far more satisfying. That's just basic human fairness, and inheritance classes are so terrified of the idea that they try to co-opt it from time to time, as in the case when Walmart workers are called associates. They are not associates, of course. They are, in fact, peons to the degree that they are famously dependent on food stamps, which in turn provide a hidden state wage subsidy to the Walmart billionaire heirs. The whole idea behind capitalism is drawing the true value of work that you do away from you, returning only a portion of it arbitrarily designated as a wage. All the rest, even if it is 50 times that amount, is taken by the capitalist, whose name comes from the fact that the power of the capitalist is derived from capital, in other words, from the fact that this person had the money first and therefore has the right to rule you as a feudal serf. This arbitrary power devolves right down to what sort of clothing you get to wear in the workplace and what time you show up and what time you go home and even when you eat or relieve yourself. Take, for example, the workers in restaurants. They will be working extra hard today. The waiting staff and the cooks know that they will have to move as if in a race much of the day, hour upon hour, no matter how long it takes to get everything set up, cooked, distributed, taken down, and cleaned. Food work can be intense. That Reuben sandwich doesn't make itself. The forks, plates, knives, and napkins and water and orders don't go to the tables by themselves. And in this particular industry, the usage of robots is so far a joke, so there is a great deal of work to be done to bring the cash, which then represents the payment for that work. But no matter how hard the cook works, no matter how fast the wait staff works, no matter how pleasant they manage to be, the income will go entirely to the owners of the restaurant, who may not even be present. And if that's a large amount of money, which it is likely to be on a day like today, then he or she keeps all of it. Even the tips are likely to be distributed in part to the owner simply because the owner can get away with it. That's extraction on a small scale, and certainly not the worst of it. And I use it because it is familiar to almost all of us. If I had my way, all of the larger restaurants would be worker-owned cooperatives. But if you look to an Amazon warehouse or to workers assembling Apple phones or Nike shoes, that is extraction on a grand scale. And the profits generated by all of those stressing, aching, working people's bodies go straight to the inheritance class, people who are born with wealth, who never did work a day in their lives, who never will, who have other people to manage their vast investments, who are able to invest in those corporations, and who are guaranteed a constant flow of money, all of which is extracted directly from the lives, the work, and ultimately the misery of the workers. Remember the famous nets that were placed around the Apple jobbers' factories to stop workers from leaping off in despair to their deaths, to the only relief they would ever know. Capitalism is extraction. In the case of the medical plasma industry, it is literally sucking the blood out of the worker. It is extracted in the healthcare industry by denying people health, but also by employing an army of people to program computers, answer phones, and manage the denial of medical care. Like penned livestock, we have become used to this and say that it is the way of the world, but in reality and in the sweep of human history, it is a relatively new form of extraction and scarcely less brutal than feudalism. At least under feudalism, the serfs had the right to exist on their land in their huts. Here we throw our excess and worn-out workers onto the sidewalks, even if they are our grandmothers or our children. It does no one any good to accept the capitalist system as normal and natural. In fact, it is a perversion of human relations. Industrial manufacturing was moving forward pretty quickly in the United States in 1886, following the extremely long post-Civil War depression, and it was possible to get a job in the big city like Chicago, although you were expected to work 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, and by doing so, one was dispensed only enough to live in a dunghill of a tenement. People organized, the Wobblies and others did, and had giant rallies, including the one at Haymarket Square, where the Chicago police decided to violently confront them. It is long a legend, and now wrongly considered a fact, that a bomb was thrown at the police at Haymarket Square. Maybe you've seen the drawing. But forensic evidence at the site showed that there was no bomb, simply because there was no shrapnel to be picked out of the nearby buildings and telephone poles, but there were hundreds of police bullets found there. There was a hysterical and loaded trial of several anarchists after that massacre, and some of the arrested were sentenced to death and one killed himself, but the rest were later pardoned, as it was generally recognized that the trial was performed to smear the labor activists and to obscure the all-too-common case of police pretending that they had been attacked when they were in fact the attackers. That's not to say that the workers didn't shoot back. They did, and thereby won your rights. If that case of the police pretending they had been attacked sounds familiar, it's because the tactic is still effective. It works fine for the police and for those portions of the population that value predictability and order above change and progress. Certainly in the United States today, police repression is preferred over any possible outbreak of democracy, the very idea of which is unfamiliar and frightening to nearly the entire population here, and that goes double for the inheritance class. The absence of an informed and participatory population has led to many horrors, not least the bloody and ongoing imperial wars, the mass incarceration, Jim Crow state, and global warming to a frightening degree. Today, the masses are encouraged to go to oval tracks and watch vehicles hurl themselves around at a dangerous and often bloody rate, exactly as was the case for the Romans 2,000 years ago. We need not fear the Visigoths, but the yachting class fears the outbreak of the very idea of socialism, to the extent that Fox News has accidentally and hilariously contributed to the hero status of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who, after all, has suggested only the most mild and basic reforms in the direction of socialism. In the context of this American society in which everything has a price tag and the most basic housing and access to water, food, and medical care, the importance of prosperity cannot be denied. The demagogue president, presenting himself as the hero of the working class, has instead deliberately misdirected trillions of dollars to the inheritance class while worsening the conditions of the people who produce that wealth. At the same time, he and his party direct a massive effort to deny the franchise to persons who cannot immediately prove their long-standing residence. In other words, they are creating a class of non-voters and making certain that that class is kept down. The resulting ultra-capitalism is a reign of terror. Terror that you will join the masses who stare at you from the curbs with imploring signs begging for scraps in the richest land on this earth. Terror that you too will be arrested on some or no pretext, brought into the courts only to discover that everyone is guilty until proven wealthy. Terror that you too will eventually die alone, friendless, and in great pain. We watch and laugh at the zombie movies and shows, but how different are the ragged zombies from the lumpen proletariat masses, the hordes that were once our friends, relatives, and co-workers who now stumble through the streets with their walkers and wheelchairs without health care, food, clean clothing, privacy, dignity, comfort, or even shade from the sun and shelter from the elements. They made poor choices, some will say, and I curse each one of you who repeats that pitiful brainwashed mantra. Better I should curse than offend you now, and that you should be stung by that, than that the day should come when that idiocy is applied to you, because it will be. And when you fall, when you break some part of your body or your mind, when your luck runs out, it'll be you. It was the Haymarket Martyrs, and by that I do not mean the police, who gave you what is left, the ghost, the shadow of the eight-hour day that still gibbers and whispers at the conscience of employers when they think of the profits they could gather to themselves if they could just make you work longer for less pay. Without unions, without an understanding of our workers' history, without organizing, that is exactly what they will do. And the ultimate profits are to be made from the ultimate system of capitalism, and that is slave labor, which has been reconstituted in our prisons today. And yes, it is along the color lines, and which is even, as I speak, taking the human rights from our millions and millions of prisoners in this police state, as it takes away productive work and wages from you. So I ask you to take a defiant stance, and to remember that this day has, deep underneath the LED screens, always been about socialism and the right of the workers, and not about department store sales and high-powered cars racing around tracks. It's the day that has been pushed to the other end of summer just to keep you from thinking of your own rights. That is the status of Labor Day as it stands in this year, 2018. I'm pleased to see that people are talking about socialism again, but even if we are again silenced, I'll remember the old stanzas. So hold the workers' banner high. Beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. That's my opinion. I'm Teresa Mitchell.
Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte continues his four-day tour of Israel today, meeting with the Filipino community, touring the Holocaust Memorial, and buying weapons. Manila began buying Israeli arms in 2017 after the relationship with the U.S. soured over concerns about human rights abuses. Duterte's regime has been waging a bloody war on drugs since 2016. Official government figures place the civilian death toll at over 4,500 in just 2 years, but human rights groups put the total much higher. During a press conference in 2016, Duterte compared himself to Adolf Hitler, saying that, quote, Hitler massacred 3 million Jews, and that he, quote, would be happy to slaughter them, referring to the 3 million drug addicts in the country. Those comments and others have contributed to public controversy surrounding his visit, but Duterte received a warm welcome from the country's leadership. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that a friendship had blossomed between the two right-wing leaders. And in Jerusalem, Duterte thanked the Israeli PM for his support in fighting Marawi rebels, saying the conflict, quote, could have dragged on were it not for the very substantial and crucial equipment from Israel. No word yet on the specifics of the most recent arms deal. Today, Duterte met with members of the Filipino community. Israeli journalists were barred from covering the meeting.
Brazilians awoke this morning to news of the devastating loss of millions of irreplaceable historical artifacts after the country's most important museum was consumed by fire late Sunday night. The National Museum in Rio de Janeiro contained Latin America's largest collection of archaeological and scientific artifacts, representing some 200 years of collection and study. Among the treasures lost in the blaze was a 1,200-year-old human skeleton known as Luisa, the oldest found in the Americas. She burned along with 20 million other items in the collection, including fossils, dinosaurs, and a meteor. Researchers and museum workers, who became aware of the fire only after it had already engulfed much of the building, worked to save what they could, but little is expected to have survived. One anthropologist compared the loss to the burning of the Library of Alexandria. The cause of the fire has not been formally announced, though the former palace did not have a working sprinkler system and had fallen into disrepair amid austerity-driven cuts to arts and educational programs in the country. Local news outlet TV Globo reported that, although firefighters were at the scene, they did not have the water needed to fight the blaze. Anger over the neglect brought protesters to the museum gates this morning, demanding access to the site and calling for the government to rebuild. Brazilian TV showed protesters being beaten back by police with batons. Brazilian President Michel Temer announced on Monday that private and public sources had pledged funds to rebuild the museum, but it is unclear what, if anything, will be left to fill it.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Labor Day, Monday, September 3rd, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman, Ken Jones, Teresa Mitchell, and Jasmine Moneymaker. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklis. The interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Philomath on translator K282BH at 104.3 FM, and in Hood River on translator K220HR at 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Mike Fdeklis. Coming up Tuesday morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio with David Barsamian. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Stage and Studio, hosted by D-May Roberts. And at 11:30, Art Focus interviews artists, curators, and critics. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Good night, Ken.
Good night, Mike. Happy Labor Day.
Thank you. You too.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today on Wings, women asylum seekers fleeing violence in Guatemala.
No puedo salir, no puedo ir a dar un vuelto allá abajo a comprar cosas que ustedes necesitan, les digo yo. Pero no puedo, porque se me quedan viendo todas las personas.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
On June 11, 2018, the United States Attorney General announced new principles for immigration judges in cases involving domestic violence or gang violence. Instead of only demonstrating a credible fear for their lives, applicants must now show that the government of their home country, quote, condoned the private actions or demonstrated an inability to protect the victims. This will make more difficult an already grueling process, documented by Maria Martin in March of 2018 for the series Making Contact. The term ICE refers to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
14 de agosto del próximo año a las 10, okay?
Outside of ICE headquarters in San Antonio, Texas, 50-year-old Albertina Gutierrez from Guatemala listens intently as her lawyers explain that her permit to stay in the United States has just been approved for one more year.
En un año, entonces.
Y mientras hay que mantenerse en contacto.
Visibly relieved, Albertina at first smiles, but then she breaks down as she recalls why she finds herself in the United States in the first place, the violence of her everyday life in Guatemala.
Se iban a matar allá. Junto con mi hijo me iban a matar y ya no quiero más regresar.
They were going to kill me, she says, along with my son. I don't want to go back. They were going to kill me and my son, and they killed my nephew.
A mi sobrino lo mataron, al hijo de mi hermano lo mataron. Se iban a matar allá.
This working-class woman from Guatemala City experienced violence on two fronts.
Los malos. Y el papá de mis hijos.
At home, from her children's father,
Me puso la pistola en la cabeza.
He threatened me with a gun, she says.
Y los malos también me pusieron la pistola en la cabeza. Me iban a matar.
And outside, gangs attempted to extort her for money. She says they too threatened her, putting a gun to her head.
Pero no quiero más allá.
Now, Albertina says she doesn't want to have anything to do with her home country, where she found nothing but guns, insecurity, and danger.
Porque no hay trabajo, sí, y la gente por eso se están metiendo los hijos de las señoras con los malos y por eso se están, ¿cómo se llama? Los están matando también a los que ya no quieren trabajar ahí.
Albertina says, and statistics agree, that there are few jobs in Guatemala. That's what's driving the children to join the gang, she says. And if they refuse to join, they kill them.
Yo vi cuando a un señor taxista, un niño como de 9 o 10 años, le tiró dos balazos a un señor taxista.
Albertina describes a young boy of 9 or 10 tried to kill a local taxi driver so he could turn over the driver's earnings to the leaders of his gang.
Dios no quiere que uno mate a las personas, ¿verdad? Y que si el niño levantó la pistola otra vez y ahí lo dejó matado.
It's been documented that gangs in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador recruit young children and train them as hired assassins in order to protect older gang members from harsher prison sentences. Guatemala, like El Salvador and Honduras, has one of the highest murder rates in the Americas. It also has the third highest rate of femicide in the world, with a high rate of impunity. All these Northern Triangle countries export a large number of migrants to the United States, including women fleeing violence.
My name is Denise Gilman. I direct the Immigration Clinic at the University of Texas Law School. It has dual goals. One is to train the new group of lawyers to do...
Attorney Denise Gilman and her student lawyers help women like Albertina navigate the immigration process. Gilman confirms this case is not unusual and that the violence she hears about from Central American women is intense.
Levels of domestic violence that would horrify most U.S. folks who just are not familiar with it. Certainly the gang violence is very serious as well. In other words, there is a lot of gender-based violence, whether it's intimate violence within the home, whether it's gangs targeting women for sexual exploitation, or gangs targeting women for doing something that they didn't like not paying extortion, by raping them or sexually assaulting them.
For Albertina, making the journey north hadn't been easy.
Me dijeron que me iban a prestar el dinero para el pasaje para poder venirme. Pero son 45,000 por mí y 6,000 por él. Pues yo tuve que venirme.
She says she took out a loan, 51,000 quetzales for a coyote, a smuggler, to take her and her son north. That's almost $7,000, a fortune for someone like her. It's a loan she's still paying back.
Que lo fuera pagando así por poquitos.
Albertina thinks about her debt and about the dangers she and all Central American migrants face crossing through Mexico.
En México, ahí matan a gente. Ahí han matado a bastante gente, emigrantes que han venido de otros países, los han matado ahí.
There in Mexico, she says, they've killed a lot of migrants. A lot of people have died, like those poor people in that trailer that they found in San Antonio. Over 100 migrants were found on a sweltering summer day in 2017 in a Walmart parking lot in San Antonio, Texas. Many were from Central America, including women and children.
These people were in that trailer without any signs of any type of water.
As outside temperatures soared above triple digits, witnesses say up to 100 illegal immigrants were crammed in the back of this semi riding from Laredo to Houston. Court documents say the victim struggled to get fresh air from a single hole in the trailer's wall because they were locked in with no air conditioning.
Se han muerto bastantes, vienen con sus niños de un año, de meses, de un mes de nacidos.
A lot of people have drowned crossing the river, says Albertina, many with small children. They bring their children with them because los malos, the bad people in Guatemala, also want to take children so they'll be part of gangs. That's why mothers and fathers flee, she says. They don't want their children to kill or be killed.
Las madres y los padres salen huyendo de allá para acá para que no los vayan a matar.
At Sonia's Mexican restaurant near ICE headquarters, Albertina shows me pictures of her grandchildren.
Pues estas son las fotos de mis nietos que yo cuidaba desde chiquititos cuando nacieron.
I took care of them since they were born, she says, and they tell me they miss me. I miss them, but repeats she has no desire to return to Guatemala to be murdered.
Yo no quiero regresar allá para que me maten.
Albertina then points out a picture of a pretty young woman in her 20s.
Esta es una de mi hija que el hombre la agarró así a la fuerza.
She says the young woman is her daughter Elsa, who was kidnapped by a man who's forcing her to live with him.
Ella está viviendo a la fuerza con él porque él dice que si lo deja a él, que la va a matar a ella.
He tells her that if she leaves, he'll kill her, says Albertina. This is a situation for many women and girls in Central America. Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras regularly rank among the countries with the highest rates of femicide in the world. In the small country of Guatemala, in two recent years, more than 2,000 women were murdered violently. Just 60 of their murderers were ever put in prison.
On Wings, you're listening to Maria Martin's documentary about women from Guatemala fleeing domestic and gang violence and applying for asylum in the U.S.
Well, I think if you take a historical view and you look at the role of women during the war, the violence in Guatemala.
Professor Lynn Steven is an anthropologist at the University of Oregon and president-elect of the Latin American Studies Association. She says the current violence plaguing countries like Guatemala began when the United States helped to overthrow the democratically elected government of Jacobo Arbenz in 1954. An insurgency arose in response, which was repressed harshly by the military. In some 40 years of state-supported violence, in the process, thousands of innocent civilians, many of them women, often indigenous, were killed and tortured.
And at least about 1,500 cases of sexual violence recorded by the Commission for Historical Memory. This historic violence is linked to femicide today, where a woman is killed about every 12 hours in Guatemala. And for indigenous women who are survivors of violence, sexual assault, it is very difficult to access justice. So often their only option is to flee for their lives.
Yo me crucé ahí a Tapachula, me crucé el río, pero me crucé ahí por las llantas que pasa la gente, ¿verdad?
Albertina's journey to the United States had begun when she took a bus to the Mexican border with Guatemala. There she and her youngest son, 8-year-old Lester, crossed the Sutiache River on rafts made from rubber tires, just like so many Guatemalans before her. I crossed and didn't even have my passport, she says. I hadn't been able to take anything with me or have time to plan because of the way I left.
Yo fui a McAllen, después me vine aquí a las citas que me ponían con el pasaporte.
It was only when she finally arrived to the border at McAllen, Texas, that Albertina filled out paperwork to apply for a new passport from the Guatemalan consulate. Crossing to the United States, she explained her situation to border officials and was given an appointment for immigration to review her status as a woman fleeing from violence. Albertina Gutierrez was able to stay in the United States due to a 2014 amendment to the immigration law that extends the definition of asylum to include women suffering from violence. Attorney Denise Gilman of the Immigration Clinic at the University of Texas.
In a nutshell, what you have to show for asylum is persecution on account of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. And the gang-based claims, as well as the DB claims, are mostly argued on the idea that the victim is a member in a particular social group, a particular kind of social class that is being targeted by the gangs, or in the case of domestic violence, that intimate partners are targeting women who are trapped in domestic relationships where they're treated as property.
Even with a hardening of immigration standards under the current administration, women are still attempting to find refuge in this country. In the summer of 2017, some immigrant women from Central America and Mexico who had applied for asylum were still receiving preliminary permission to leave detention after being stopped at the border. We met some of them at the Greyhound bus station in San Antonio, Texas, on a muggy August day. Among the passengers waiting for their destinations to be called are small groups of confused-looking women, mostly young, holding babies or small children, and looking a little overwhelmed. So far from home, they tried to figure out their next steps in their flight from violence. Alessandra is 19 years old and comes from the northern Guatemalan province of El Petén. El Petén is known for the Mayan ruins of Tikal and more recently for being taken over by los narcos, the drug cartels whose members often force women into drugs and prostitution.
Pues entonces yo me vine de allá porque a mí me amenazaron que vendiera droga y me prostituyera. Entonces fue el motivo que yo me vine porque como también me dijeron que si no lo hacía mataba a mi niña.
Well, I left there, she says, because they threatened me. They wanted me to carry drugs, to become a prostitute for them. I came here because they told me they were going to kill my little girl if I didn't do this.
Pues entonces me vine a estar acá.
Alessandra says she had no family to go to in Guatemala, but did have some relatives in the United States. She was detained crossing the border, but was able to apply for asylum through the Violence Against Women Act.
Actually, there are refugees that have been detained in those camps. Some of them come from, we have in Texas here near San Antonio, we have two big ones. One is in Karnes County and the other one is in Dilley.
Sister Consuelo is a volunteer with the immigrant legal group Raices in San Antonio. Volunteers like Consuelo go to the bus station each day to seek out women needing assistance, women like Alessandra.
Once they process them and that they can be classified as refugees and not immigrants, then they find where is it here in the States that somebody can harbor them, that somebody can host them. Family members, or relatives, or friends, or whatever. And once they declare that they are refugees for whatever reason, and that someone here in the States can take them and can host them, then they figure out, then they call those people, and then they arrange for them to come, to go to them, and then they give them the bus ticket to here to San Antonio, and from San Antonio, they go to wherever they're going. Some of them are on the bus for 2 or 3 days before they arrive to their destination.
Sister Consuelo is called a backpack volunteer because she brings grocery sacks with snacks, bottled water, and things like disposable diapers to give to the women.
It's an organization called Raices here in San Antonio. We work through the Presbyterian Church here, which is downtown, which is 2 blocks away from here. We store our supplies that we give them because we give them basic things, you know, that they need for the trip, like a sandwich or clothes or medications or whatever they need.
The volunteers also explain what lies ahead in the next few days to these confused refugees, the long distances they'll have to travel, and where to change buses on their long trip to their destinations. None speak English, some only their indigenous language.
She is going from San Antonio to Indianapolis. De San Antonio a Dallas. De Dallas a Nashville.
We spoke to these women 7 months into the Trump administration. Despite the harder line immigration crackdown, women are still going through a lot to escape the threats and the carnage in Central America. While the women in the San Antonio bus station wait in Iowa or Chicago or Dallas to see what their fate will be when it comes to immigration court, other women in Central America, also facing threats and violence daily, are not as lucky. In the small indigenous village of San Angelin in northern Guatemala, Rosa Maria Mendez prays in her Mayan language for her daughter, Lucia, who, in her short life, has already been through so much.
Siempre he estado triste. Hay veces que me pongo a pensar muchas cosas. ¿Por qué me ha pasado esos problemas? ¿Por qué me sucedió eso? Nunca me imaginé mi vida iba a pasar todo esto.
Sitting in the patio of her humble stucco home, chickens scrambling on the ground, Lucia tells us that her life has always been hard. Sometimes she says, I wonder why so many bad things have happened to me. I never imagined life would be like this.
Para mí fue muy difícil vivir el problema que yo tuve. Fue demasiado complicada para mí.
When she was only 13, Lucia was raped by a 30-year-old neighbor in her small and isolated Mayan community. San Angelin is located in the mountains of the northern province of Huehuetenango. Lucia's father, Tomás, continues the story.
Lo que pasó, tenía ahí una prima atrasita de la casa, que la prima le iba a prestar un CD. E inmediatamente yo le dijo que Martín no está. Al ratito cuando Martín llegó, estaba llorando.
Tomás says his daughter Lucia had gone to borrow a CD from a neighbor and came home crying. He didn't understand what was going on, but little by little, the story came out. And in a radical move, the 13-year-old and her parents brought legal action against her older, more powerful rapist.
Pero como Martín estaba bien jodido, inmediatamente nos fuimos a denunciar allá en San Martín, en la auxiliatura.
But as a consequence of taking legal action, the family began to receive threats and was harassed in public. It got so bad that Lucia began to think of leaving.
Dije, ya no puedo más, mamá. Ya no puedo más, papá. Ayúdame, ¿qué hago? Ya no soporto estar aquí. Necesito estar en un lugar lejos.
I just couldn't stand it here, she says. I needed to be far away. Lucia asked her parents to help her pay a coyote, a smuggler, to take her north. She had a sister in the United States.
Y cuando cruzamos en el desierto, allí se sufrí mucho, pero nada más le pedí a Dios que no me pasara nada. Me quedé en el desierto casi 4 días. Me quedé sola.
Immigration agents found Lucia in the desert, where she'd been left alone for 4 days. Then she was deported, arriving in Guatemala in time to testify against her rapist. But as the legal process went on, Lucia and her family received more threats, and again, she just couldn't face her rapist in court.
Yo no voy a soportar aquí, madre, papá. Yo me voy a ir a un lugar lejos donde pueda estar más tranquilo, más seguro.
Looking once again for a safe space, Lucia went to Playa del Carmen, Mexico, where she also had relatives. But there, too, she felt she was being watched and followed.
Andaba dos tipos grandes. No tenían pelo, son, como dije, sin pelo tenía, andaban buscando a mí.
There were two big bald men, she says, asking around regarding her whereabouts, showing people her photograph on a tablet. Where could she go to be safe? She decided to once again attempt to find refuge in the United States.
Me fui otra vez en Estados Unidos, intenté, quiero llegar, necesito estar allá, protegido, no sé.
Deported for the second time, Lucia returned to her small village in Guatemala, where she's been for 2 years now. Small and slight, Lucia is now 20. Most of the time, she's too afraid and too ashamed to leave her parents' home.
No puedo salir. No puedo ir a dar un vuelto allá abajo a comprar cosas que ustedes necesitan, le digo yo. Pero no puedo, porque se me quedan viendo todas las personas.
In her small community, she thinks people are talking about me. She says she's trying to be calmer about her situation, but there's no doubt she lives in fear, especially since her rapist was released from jail early. He's told Lucia's family that any day, someone could enter their home.
Los tengo mucho miedo a ellas. Por esa razón no salgo. Y el señor puede estar en cualquier parte, me puede hacer daño porque él todavía me sigue amenazando.
He and his family are still threatening me, she says. He could be anywhere. That's why I don't go out. I'm afraid he'll do something. I'm afraid that one day he'll come here and kill us all.
Porque ellos están diciendo que algún día van a entrar a matarnos aquí en la casa.
Lucia hopes she can leave her village and go someplace where she isn't in constant fear for her life. But immigration experts say that increasingly, finding refuge in the United States is not an option. Again, immigration attorney Denise Gilman.
Basically, what's happening is that along pretty significant chunks of the southern U.S. border, asylum seekers who attempt to approach the immigration authorities in the United States to ask for asylum and to be sort of led into the process, to be led into detention, really, to seek asylum, are being turned away. They're simply not allowed to even come onto U.S. soil to seek asylum, although it's pretty clear that the law does not allow authorities to turn back people who are seeking asylum in that way. And in fact, there is litigation pending that has already been
filed. Gilman says that perhaps a year ago, Lucia's case might have been approved for asylum based on the Violence Against Women Act. But with the hardening of President Trump's immigration policies, she doesn't see much chance for this young woman or others like her to find refuge from violence in this country.
We are absolutely seeing repeatedly situations where people come to the border, to the bridge, and they tell an immigration official, a U.S. immigration official, that they are seeking asylum, that they're afraid of returning home. And the border official says, no, no, we're not doing asylum anymore. Or you don't have an asylum claim. Or we're busy, we're full, we don't have time, go back.
The principle of asylum and the right of those seeking it to not be returned to countries where they are likely to be harmed or killed was enshrined into international law after World War II. But recent investigations indicate this right is being violated on a regular basis by customs and border patrol agents. In 2017, asylum judges rejected some 60% of asylum seekers. This was the highest denial rate in over 10 years. The head of the U.S. justice system, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, is no supporter of the asylum process and has himself criticized what he calls rampant fraud and abuse in the asylum system. So is the political climate in the United States that once helped women seek refuge from violence becomes less friendly, women around the world have less and less recourse to escape situations that continue to threaten and even kill them.
This program was written and produced by Maria Martin in Guatemala. Reporting for this project was made possible by a grant from FIJ, the Fund for Investigative Journalism.
Wings thanks Making Contact for sharing this program. You can find their archives and information at radioproject.org. For more about Wings, visit wingsradio.org or email wings@wings.org. And you can find our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
The time is 6 p.m. You are in tune to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Holla! My name is Tina Turner Morfitt. I am a retiree of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Union. And I'm also the president of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists here in